She is dreaming, she is drifting, never been so wide awake. Captured in the moment by the beauty all around her, there's nowhere else that she would rather be.
Hello and welcome. This is Karen Motokaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It, the place where inspiration and possibility meet on KDRT 95.7 FM. Today, we're talking about money, 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 money. And Mark Butler is going to be here, and we are going to be talking about annual reviews and checking in with your money. I know it kind of sounds dry, doesn't it? But it gets good. And at first we start talking and it sounds like it's only for the entrepreneur, but don't worry. I bring it in so that whether you are self-employed or employed, it's about how do you handle your money? And we talk about important things about like money and shame. We wind up using comparisons to like dieting and being restrictive and what choices that you want to make and how to stay out of shame when you're looking at your money. So listen in and then I will circle back afterwards and be with you. Mark Butler, hello and welcome back.
Hi, Corinne. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. So what's on your mind in terms of money today?
Money today. I am being the first of the year and having a business that's kind of an outsourced CFO bookkeeping service. I'm neck deep in year-end wrap-ups with clients and in the beginning of the year planning process with clients. So I have planning and forecasting on the brain right now.
So do you not do the wrap-ups before 2015 ends?
You really can't because you need the transactions all to post, you know, on December 31st. And so you really can't jump into your year-end stuff before January 1st. I can do some pre-work, but there's not a lot of time saved in jumping in early. So my team and I just jump in on the 1st of January and start cranking out year-ends for people.
And why, Mark, is it so important to do a year-end wrap-up and an annual review?
Well, from a tax prep perspective, it's good to do that as early in the new year as possible so you can just be done stressing about it. You don't want it to be early April and you're scrambling to gather receipts or track down transactions that happened in the previous February, that sort of mess. So you want to be doing your bookkeeping throughout the year, and then as the year wraps up, you want to make sure that everything's tidy and you're sending stuff off to your tax preparer so it's smooth. But as far as a year-end review, you want to look at everything that happened in the last year with your money so that you can just have the awareness around that. You know, sometimes I'll have clients who, as we approach the end of the year, I'll send them an email and say, hey, do you realize that you're going to crush the previous year's revenue by 80%? Or, hey, do you realize that even though you've had what felt like a really, really difficult year, you actually are more profitable this year than last year? So it's good to have moments to reflect and celebrate the work that you did. Even if the year didn't go as you planned or as you wanted it to, there's still something to be learned from that because you can understand, I thought the year would go this way. It actually went that way. What was going on in my head that created my plan versus the action that I worked on throughout the year to make that plan a reality? So reviews are really beneficial to help you improve your planning process and congratulate yourself on the successes you had.
And is there ever a review where it's, oh no, you didn't do as well as you were thinking or your goal set out to be?
Yeah, I think so. I think when people are new to the planning process, meaning they haven't done it very many years, people tend to seriously overestimate what they can accomplish in 1 year. And they tend to also underestimate what they will spend in a given year. So this could apply to both business finances and personal finances, but especially business owners, because of our nature as optimists, we tend to be really optimistic and really blue sky in our revenue forecasts. And we tend to be equally blue sky in our expense forecasts. So you get these forecasts sometimes where people are like, well, yeah, I mean, based on my plan, I'm going to make $1 million this year. And it's like, well, okay, talk me through the plan and point me to the milestones, the kind of leading indicators that will carry you to that $1 million or 100,000 or 10,000, whatever it is. People who haven't planned very many years tend to be too aggressive in what they can accomplish in 1 year and not aggressive enough in what it will cost to do that. On the other hand, though, people tend to seriously underestimate what they can accomplish over a 5-year period, because if you really buckle down over a 1 and 2 year period and you just do work and do work and do work, in years 3, 4, and 5, you'll shock yourself at how there's kind of a hockey stick moment in your, you know, in your revenue graph. Like it just all of a sudden points up, and you'll be surprised at that. But you'll, if you look back at those years, you'll realize actually that's just the fruit of those early months and years of effort that didn't feel very productive, but they were building momentum for me. So yeah, sometimes people fall short of what they hoped to do. Hopefully they can keep that in context though, and just continue plugging away at the work that they know is meaningful and productive.
But it sounds like, at least with your clients, because you guys are doing monthly check-ins, right? So it's not like you're going to come to December and they're not going to know that they are off pace, because
right,
every month there's been a check-in. Whereas if somebody's doing this on their own, and they can, we're not trying to sell your services here, but
right,
you can do this on your own. But probably why all of a sudden you're getting blindsided is you haven't been checking in every month.
Absolutely. That's so true. It's really fun, and it's euphoric to create an annual plan. I mean, because it's pure optimism, it's pure, you know, it's big thinking, it's limitless thinking, and that's fun. Unfortunately, people do tend to create their plan and then not refer back to it. Or when they do refer back to it for the first time, they already feel like they're so far from where they wanted to be that they'll throw the plan out and just sort of be like, well, I guess it's just business as usual, because my plan wasn't accurate from the get-go, so I might as well throw away the plan. But you don't want to do that. You want to create the plan in such a way that you can make it flexible. There's nothing wrong with changing the plan. There's something wrong with changing your effort, your intensity, your focus. But if you get a month into the year and you're reviewing your plan and you're saying, you know, I think I probably overshot by about double what's realistic based on the inputs that I can realistically count on, I'm going to back off that plan. I'm just not going to back off my intensity. You're not quitting. You're not giving up. There's no requirement in entrepreneurship to be clairvoyant, right? So sometimes people, they're really hard on themselves when they create a plan and then very early in the year they realize the plan's not going to work. Well, so what? There's no like psychic penalty points. Like, it doesn't matter. You use the plan to drive your activity, and then as the activity bears fruit or doesn't, then you adjust the plan, but you continue in the activity. The planning process is mostly valuable in exposing your assumptions about what it will take to succeed. So if I create a revenue plan and I say I'm going to do 300,000 in revenue this year instead of 150,000, so I'm going to double, then I need to back that $300,000 revenue goal into how many clients did I have to get to 150,000 in revenue, and what was my revenue per client? How am I going to move the revenue needle? Will it be higher earnings per client? Will it be more clients? If it's higher earnings per client, am I going to raise rates for my existing clients? Am I going to replace my existing clients with those that pay higher? How do I get there? And once you realize what it takes to actually get there, then you have to sit with that reality and say, okay, well, if my average client now pays me X and I really need to get to 2X, if I want to reach my revenue goal, do I really believe I can charge 2X? And it's different for every one of us, whether or not we can kind of buy into the plan. And sometimes I think that the plan will mostly succeed or fail based on whether we truly can buy into it. But there's nothing wrong with backing off of a plan because you just feel like, I don't know if I can do that this year. In my case, you know, if I did about 150,000 in revenue in 2015. A $300,000 goal feels like a stretch. A $500,000 goal feels silly. So it would be easy to put $500,000 into a spreadsheet for me. But I don't think I could really buy into it. But with $300,000, I can look at my client list. I can look at what I charge each client, and I can get myself to where I'm like, you know what? I think I could get there. But I'm not gonna call myself a loser if I don't. I'm just gonna chase it.
Well, and that's the big thing, is the stories that you tell yourself, right? So I think one of the things that people are afraid of doing reviews or doing plans is that they're actually putting down what it is that they want.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you have a story that, oh, I can't really have what I want, of course it's going to get in the result of that. And then next year, at the end of the year, you'll have this evidence, I created this, but what Corinne and Mark are talking about is just a waste of time because it doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
But really it's about doing the work in your brain of what do you believe, and being like what you're saying, you're like, okay, $500,000 is silly, but $300,000, it's a stretch, and I can figure out the math. And am I going to be vulnerable? Yeah, because there's uncertainty, right? There's exposure, there's risk, especially when you come on the show and share that that's your goal. But go do it and then readjust. And it doesn't, I guess, define you, right? If you make it or don't make it, it's just a matter of, okay, what do I want to do? What do I need to do to create this?
Right. Right.
And just for the listeners who are like going, okay, I'm not a coach or I'm not a business owner, I have my salary. I think this is also an important comment because, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the year, whether maybe you didn't have enough money for taxes or you didn't put in the money that you wanted for retirement or whatever it may be, is, okay, if I know this is how much money I'm going to have, what's the kind of lifestyle I want to have, and where do I want to put those dollars?
Right.
And where did some of those dollars maybe go into expenses that there really wasn't great return? And I mean, like, great return in, you know, oh, I spent money here and I spent money there, and that money put together could have been money put into my retirement account if that's my priority to me.
You make a good point too, Corinne, because my younger brother and I have a weekly just checking with each other. We used to be business partners, and then we sold the business we owned together, and he went to work with a company that bought our business, and I kind of headed back towards self-employment. And so he made a comment to me the other day that he really likes employment. Employment feels good to him, feels right to him. The thing he misses about self-employment is that there's just this blue sky nature to the whole thing. Like, well, you feel like you have so much power to move the needle, and you have the easiest scoreboard that could be, because you can just use money as the scoreboard. You can use revenue and profit as the scoreboard. Whereas in an employment situation, your income's probably fixed. But what he and I realized in our conversation was sometimes we as self-employed people, because revenue and profits are such an easy thing to measure and such an easy thing to get excited about, we don't always do work in the areas of our lives that would probably pay a bigger dividend than more money. It seems obvious to say, well, more money's not always the answer, but of course more money's not always the answer. So in my brother's situation, his income will probably increase something in 2016, but he has slightly harder to measure goals that will actually deliver big happiness to his life. They just don't have the same sex appeal as revenue, profit. But for him, he's thinking about things like, I want to be a lot more effective as a leader. He leads a team of five or six at his company. And we're trying to figure out how he can set goals to know that he's improving as a leader. We're coming up with things that are measurable that indicate improvement as a leader. So I just think you made a good point, because if you can't really move the needle in your life with income or that sort of thing, you can look at optimizing your spending, as you said, and you can look at optimizing areas of your life that will deliver as much or more happiness than improved earnings.
Well, yeah, and I think an annual review, I still think it's important personally to do an annual review of your money. You know, are you creating, like, with the dollars you have, if you are employed and you know this is how much and you get a 2% raise, you know, if you're lucky, a cost of living raise every year, and this is the money. I mean, I used to have one of those kinds of jobs, right? Mm-hmm. I knew for the next 40 years how much money I would make, and then I knew what my pension would be theoretically, right? But if you know that that's how much money you make, what are the choices that you're doing with that money? Is that in line with what you had set out for at the beginning of the year? And if there's a discrepancy, what do you want to change? Or are you okay with it?
Yeah, love it. It's so true. Because I'm prepping for a class I'm teaching about money here in a couple of weeks. And something I've been thinking about a lot is trying to get people to understand that whatever you do with your money, the purchase you're making is really the purchase of a feeling. You're using that money because you want to feel a certain way. And so if once you realize that, then you can do an annual review of your spending and you can look at broad categories, you know, whatever those categories are, the big discretionary categories like clothing and restaurants and entertainment and vacation and stuff like that. And you can look at the amount you spent in those categories. And then you can ask yourself, what was the feeling I was seeking from that spending? And did I get it? If I did get it, then I should not only spend that much, but I should probably increase my spending in that area. And in any area where I was pursuing a feeling and I didn't get the feeling I was pursuing, I can back off the spending, knowing that in backing off that spending, I'm not losing anything because I didn't get what I wanted from the spending in the first place. I'd rather shift that money into an area where I get the feeling I want. Sometimes that will be shifting it toward retirement. Sometimes it will be shifting it toward the elimination of debt. Sometimes it'll be shifting into buying more shoes. And that's a totally appropriate direction to shift your money once you realize exactly why you're doing it.
And so Mark, as soon as you said, well, if I'm getting this feeling that I wanted, then I can spend more money there, I literally heard screeching of tires of the listeners out there going, wait, what did he just say? Because it goes against like all the personal finance rules. Right. Like, and I think about like Ramit Sethi, who's been on the show, and, you know, he's so against the don't drink a latte. You know, there's, I think it's David Bach who's, you know, don't, if you don't drink lattes, look how much money you'll save. And that's why I'm really cautious about, like, you know, because for me, I mean, I do have my latte from my local coffee shop, and that is a choice. I am willing to spend, it's now $5.40, but it just got raised. I was looking at that this week, but I make that choice, you know, because I thought about it because it went at 40 cents. I'm like, really? Am I, you know, do I really want to spend this money? It just went at 40 cents. I mean, I can afford the 40 cents, right? But I had to think about it. And I'm like, it's still worth it. And this is, I really like it. It tastes really yummy. And it fits within the parameters that I have set forward.
Yeah, I think that too often in the personal finance world, the easiest advice to give is the don't spend advice. Oh, don't spend. The latte factor, just like you said. It's the latte factor. And the reason it's so effective is because it plays to people's shame. I know we talked about shame last time, but when you hammer on people not to spend money, that really validates their feeling of, yeah, I'm not good enough. I shouldn't spend money because I'm a bad person. I make bad decisions. My spending proves that. If I spent less, if I spent on fewer luxuries, I would become a better person. I would like myself more. And it, to me, it's just completely false. The reality is everything you do with your money is spending. Sometimes you're spending that money on future expenses. That just happens to be called saving. But you're still spending that money on a feeling. You're spending the money on the feeling of, I know that I'm going to have expenses in the future. It feels good to know that I'm caring for future me and my future, you know, my future goals. That's what I'm choosing to spend my money on. I'm also going to spend some of my money on today, and that's going to be my latte, or it's going to be eating out, or it's going to be shoes. I just had a client tell me that she sets these goals in her business, and every time she reaches one of these goals, she buys herself cowboy boots, and they're like $700 cowboy boots. And I think that's fantastic. That's great. Because why would you hoard the money when hoarding it actually doesn't do anything? You know, spend it, spend a lot of it on your future self and spend a lot of it on your current self. But spend it with full awareness of the feeling you're pursuing and your alternatives. What else could I do to achieve that same feeling? Could I have that same feeling for less money? That's maybe more optimal. You have to be willing to explore those things, but it's always an evaluation that you can do without being ashamed. There's just no reason to beat yourself up about any part of it.
Oh, I think that's so important, right? It's about really looking at it from what I call being a compassionate observer, watching from that lens. And that way you can reflect and say, okay, this is the feeling I want. This is the feeling I get. Mm-hmm. You know, but how else? I mean, purchasing things or spending money isn't the only way to get those feelings.
No, of course not. Yeah.
And to really look at that, because, you know, our minds are, I mean, my mind, gosh, it can really twist things up. So I'm bringing this to light, because then that's how I used to eat 3 bowls of ice cream every night, and telling myself right. I deserved it, right? Because there was the right words. You deserve it, Corinne. This is a form of self-care. And that was like the biggest lie I would tell myself. But, and I do, I really like good coffee. I mean, people, that's the one thing I'll have to say. I am a bit of a coffee snob, and so I won't just go anywhere. And we've got this great local coffee roaster in town, and I will spend the money. And it's funny, because there was a time when I really bought into the whole personal development, like in my 20s and 30s, you know, be really frugal, don't spend money, you know, be restrictive, all of that stuff. And really, I think about, like, one of my financial mentors taught me this, is what is the value that you're getting back, right? And now here's the reality. If I drank 3 Breve lattes every single day, that wouldn't be feeling, I wouldn't feel very good.
Right.
And the amount of, you know, and spending that much money, right, there would be a drain. So I would eventually, even though having one is yummy, it's delicious, and I don't know what the feeling would be bring, but, you know, I guess it's enjoyment, right? Having 3 doesn't make it more enjoyment.
No.
And so there's that container, there's that boundary around that.
There has to be, what matters here is the constant willingness to self-examine, you know, compassionately, like you said, because there, I don't like rules. I don't like these broad sweeping rules that you hear in the money world, because they don't leave room for self examination and evaluation, you know, compassionate self-evaluation. So they're, if you're feeling like you're doing something out of entitlement, well, how do I say this? If you're doing something and you are having that sort of, I deserve this thought, or this is a form of self-care. Because
you can say it's out of entitlement. Yeah. No,
I think the way you discover whether you're acting in an entitled way or really pursuing self-care is just through that examination. So I think that in most areas of our spending, there's probably a relatively small consequence to just sort of going for it. You know, like with the latte thing, like, well, I once had a client tell me that he felt like in order to just not have the mental overhead of preparing his own lunch, he was going to literally, he said, I promise you, I'm going to go to this cafe that's just near my house. It's $20 each time I eat there. And we just need to budget $20 times however many days there are in the month, every, you know, for the entire year. And, you know, I feel like traditional financial thinking would be like, well, don't you realize there's about 20 working days in a month, and that's $400 a month, and that's $5,000 a year, and how dare you? And no, I said, okay, great, I'll put it in the budget. And I just put the money in the budget. And I said, we'll just be talking about that, because I actually didn't have a judgment of that decision. I just was going to put the number in the budget and say, let's just keep that on our radar and see how you feel as you go. Well, weeks passed, and we'd revisit that line item in the budget, and he would say, you know, I actually kind of like staying home, just kind of eating here. And I do like the walk, though. So instead of eating out, I'm just going to have a quick bite at my house here, and then I'm going to go walk around the block a couple times. Because I found out that it was really the walk that I enjoyed, getting away from my desk, clearing my head, moving. That's the part I cared about. So I'll eat at home, and I'll just, you know, walk around the block twice. So he got the feeling that he wanted. He thought the money was necessary to that feeling initially, and then found out later that it wasn't. That happens in a lot of areas, but not every area. And that's why I don't like rules. So you can do the experiment. Now, where you need to be careful, of course, is when you're going to do something where the consequence of being wrong is pretty undesirable. If you were to say, well, I really think that the feeling I want, I can get by buying a new car, leasing a new car, financing a new car, or spending cash on a new car. Well, that might be one to sit with a little longer, because the consequence of getting that one wrong is a little bit harder to deal with. So we need to find ways to before purchasing the car, tease out what's the feeling we're really pursuing. Is the car really necessary to that feeling? I'm okay with the answer being yes, the car is necessary to that feeling. But the consequences of getting that one wrong are a little bit tougher. So it probably deserves a little bit more of a delay before you make that commitment. But with the day, you know, daily lunch at the cafe down the street, that's a pretty cheap experiment to discover what feeling you're really pursuing.
And I appreciate you having those, right? There's, again, for me, $5.40, it's not going to change. I always go back to, is it going to change my family's life?
Right.
Right. Where a car, especially if you get into a lease, that could change your family's life.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if all of a sudden you start to default on the loan and what does it do to your credit and all of that. So I think having those parameters are really, really important. And going back to, you know, us talking about an annual review and a year-end wrap-up, right? It's, I love this idea of closing out the year and seeing where you were and, you know, how did it align to what you thought? And then creating a plan for the upcoming year and constantly checking in, so that your head's not in the sand. And so whether you're self-employed or you're employed, we can all do this. It's about honoring that commitment to ourselves. What do you think?
Totally. Absolutely. When you create the plan in the first place, you want to take the time to make it as detailed as possible and do work on each aspect of it. Do as much work on each aspect of it as possible. And what I mean by that is, we talked about revenue, but you can also do the same thing with expense. I'll look at a line item and I'll say, well, how much am I going to spend this year on help, on staff? Mm-hmm. And I'll really do work on who am I going to be writing those checks to? Why am I going to be writing those checks? What result do I think that will create in my business? And then when I check in on my plan weekly, monthly, quarterly, I'm revisiting the goal for the money and asking myself whether it delivered what I wanted, and then changing my plan accordingly. But that's when planning becomes powerful, when you're willing to do the work initially and then to revisit often. So my wife laughs at me because sometimes she'll just see me just staring at my laptop, sort of like blank stare at my laptop for an extended period of time. And she'll be like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, just looking at my budget. And what I'm doing is I'm looking at individual categories in my budget. And I'm like trying to visualize, why does this money exist in my business? What am I actually intending for this money to do? And would I rather use it elsewhere? Right now, today, you know, for the last few months, I've been thinking, I'm either going to take 10 or 15 grand and spend it on a rebrand, a new website, new, the whole deal, or I'm going to hire a full-time assistant. And I can't have a full-time assistant for $15,000, of course, but that's, you know, probably a third of what she'll cost for the whole year. And I say she because I've already hired her. And I finally was, after, you know, many sessions of just staring at this budget and thinking hard about the business and kind of what I want to be when I grow up, I decided the website can wait till later in the year. I'm going to hire the assistant and let that drive growth that pays for the website. But I only have those experiences by staring at the real numbers and deciding what to do with them.
Well, and it has to be, it sounds like, where you're just looking at the numbers and there's not the drama in your head.
Right.
Right? The stories of, well, if I, you know, want to do this, then I have to have this website, or you look at the numbers and go, okay, that you get really clear stories, right, of what can happen. And again, there's still predictions.
Right.
Because you don't know until you go out and do it, but you really kind of think through it without coming from this scarcity place or this frantic place of like, oh my gosh, I have to do it and I have to do it right now and I have to do all of it right now, which can get a lot of people in trouble, can't it?
Oh, so much trouble. Where I was listening to a podcast the other day, Tim Ferriss. It was the Tim Ferriss podcast, and he had a guy on it named Derek Sivers. Mm-hmm. And the guy said something that I just thought was amazing, which was, you have time to do everything you want to do in life. You know, if you're 40 years old, you can have 4 10-year projects still in your life and just, you know, and crush it with all 4 of those 10-year projects. So never mind if they're 5-year projects, you know, you can have a lot more 5-year projects. And to me, that just gave me this like, oh man, that's so true. Like, I got to just relax, because my current business is my current project. It may be a 5-year business. It may be a 10-year business, or I may do it for the rest of my life, but it's okay to push off some of the shiny objects and some of the fear of missing out things kind of running around in your head in any given moment, because there really is time for all of it. So just come back to today's reality, using today's numbers as the guide for the conversation, and let those other things let them wait.
Yeah, I love that idea of 4 10-year projects, right? Because Now you're like, oh, there's plenty of time, instead of what's the typical story. I was thinking about a conversation I had with somebody some years ago, and he was about to turn 50, and he's like, oh my gosh, you know, I got to get this work done. I need to be doing epic work. And in his career, and you know, he's like, I've got 10 years left. And if I don't do it, it's not going to happen. Instead of looking at it, I still have 3 10-year blocks.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the key, is once you let go of this old false idea of retirement, where you have to work for a bunch of years and then hard stop on work, and now you start enjoyment. Once you let go of that and you realize that each individual project in your life can and needs to be a source of enjoyment on its own, then this imaginary deadline that we all have of whatever it is, I'm going to retire by 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 or whatever it is, it goes away, because you realize I'm always going to want to do work that I enjoy. For some of that work, I'm going to receive payment. Other times I won't receive payment. That won't be the nature of the work, but I'm always going to be doing work that I enjoy. And I don't need to have any weird false deadlines on my productive life.
I love that. So I want to go back to this annual review. What are the important components to have in an annual review?
It's two sides of the same coin for your revenue and your spending. On the revenue side, you want to get real clarity around how you made your money. If you're a business owner, you know, where did I actually get my money from? Sometimes I really surprise my clients when I tell them, hey, did you know that this thing that really doesn't require much work from you, and you think of it as very much of a tack-on aspect of your business, do you realize that it put, you know, it accounted for a third of your profit, for example? And they'll be blown away, because they'll say, well, that's the easiest part of my business. I just don't even really do anything for that. And it brought me a third of my profit. I had no idea. Right. So that's why we need to be reviewing in a zoomed out way. So you want to know where your money's coming from. You want to be looking at each of those revenue streams in terms of their hassle. I talk to my clients and I talk to my team all the time about keeping our hassle per dollar in check. So I tend to be a sales-oriented, revenue-oriented business owner, and sometimes I'll say yes to prospects and I'll make commitments that make the hassle per dollar in my business too high. In an annual review, I can take clients and put them side by side and say, well, what's his hassle per dollar? What's her hassle per dollar for me? And sometimes it leads to difficult conversations with those clients where I say, listen, I'm underpriced. It's my fault. But in order for our relationship to stay healthy, I have to raise your rate. And it's in an annual review that you can be reviewing that all the time, but those things really become clear when you zoom out and look at an annual basis, an annual set of numbers. So where's my money coming from? How much hassle is each of those dollars to earn? And how can I improve that hassle per dollar? That's the revenue side. And then, of course, how can I get of the low hassle dollars, how can I go produce more of those? On the expense side, it's kind of the same thing, just viewed through a different lens. It's where did my money go by broad category and then by more narrow categories. So broad categories being things like fixed costs, my housing, my health insurance, these things that are maybe a little bit harder to change in the short term, but definitely possible to change in the long term. So I look at my fixed costs and how much of their money, how much of my money they're taking. And then you look at discretionary variable categories, you know, and as you look at those things and say, well, I spent X on clothing and I spent Y on, you know, dining out, I spent Z on vacation, would I like to shift those dollars around? For some reason, it's just easier to see those patterns when you look at a year worth of spending at a time. So you look at your revenue, you look at your expenses, and you make decisions about how you want to shift things around in your business. And if you don't own a business, if you don't have variable income, then it actually simplifies things with one exception. You know how I just said that housing is a fixed cost in the short run? In the short term, it's hard to change that because you got to sell the house or you got to move, uproot your family, whatever it is. But in the long term, you can set that up and you can do it. It's the same thing on the revenue side of your life with your job. In the short term, it might be hard to get out of a job that's expensive relative to its value, if that makes sense. It's expensive in your boss being a jerk or it being really far from your home or not having close friends at work or not paying you enough. Those are the costs of the job. And so you can look for a better hassle per dollar situation in your job. And you can say, okay, I'm going to put myself on a 2 or 3 year plan to be in a better earning situation, either more money or the same money or less money, but better relationships at work, challenging work, rewarding work. Take the opportunity in an annual review to make those evaluations of your job and create plans accordingly.
Oh, those are, you know, especially for the job thing, because there's probably a lot of people out there that can relate to that, right? Expensive relative to the value, a better hassle per dollar job. And thinking of that instead of, well, I make X, how can I ever get paid this amount? Because that goes back to this whole idea of the annual review. So whether it's the self-employed or the employed, it's not just how much money you're making.
No.
But, you know, there's other costs that are involved in that, and to take a look at that.
Right. In a job, it's like the money is kind of the least important part of a job. And that's easy to say, you know.
Okay, because, again, cars are screeching to a halt because this is not what we've been taught in America.
Well, it's, you know, there needs to be a base level of income, and sometimes you can't get around it. There are times when you know, this isn't all flowers and puppy dogs. Like, sometimes you just got to show up and do the job, even though you hate it. And that's, in the short term, that's fine. But in the long term, you just have to be willing to take ownership of your job. I actually did some impromptu consulting the other day with the staff of one of my clients. And luckily, she was very cool about it. But they'd had some issues internally. And she was asking me to give them an outside perspective on the whole situation. And I said, guys, listen, you got to take responsibility for your employment situation. And if your employment situation is undesirable, then you have to set yourself up to leave it. But you can't sit back in a victim position and blame an employer for your circumstances. Because in the long run, you have 100% control over your employment situation. So how do you set yourself up to get there? Well, first of all, you negotiate with your employer in a healthy, loving sounds like a weird word, but I think you'll know what I mean. You, in a very open-minded, mutually beneficial way, you negotiate with your employer about the current reality. And you say, here's what I need in order to feel healthy and productive as your employee. It's your responsibility to do that. And if you don't do that, then you can't blame anybody for your unhappiness in the job. And then if you really can't get from that job what you need in order to feel healthy and happy, then you have to set yourself up to leave it by improving your employability, building a cash reserve so that you have a cushion between the job you don't like and the job you hope to get, and all these kinds of things. But at the end of the day, if you know what you need to earn, then it's your responsibility to go earn it in the healthiest way possible. And the money, I don't have any experience at this point seeing people who've pursued strictly money and come out and been the better for it.
Well, one of the books that we both like is Your Money or Your Life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Love it.
And that's, I mean, that there's evidence right there of it doesn't, I don't think it has to be one or the other. You can make good money and enjoy your life. But I've also gone after the money, and it was gut-wrenching. It was soul-wrenching. So
it's true. It really is. There's something. So the other side of that is people who never stick to anything because they haven't discovered their quote-unquote passion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not for that either. I know I'm sure you're not. There's something to be learned, something to be gained from having to shovel manure at the job you hate over an extended period of time. It develops your skills. It hardens you against adversity. Lots of great things come from it. So you do need to stick with a job until you feel that it's given you what it can give you in terms of personal growth, new skills, marketability, and income.
And maybe a savings so that you can leave.
You have to have the savings. See, this is what I've told people before is, and this is just as true in an employment situation as it is in a self-employed situation. I'm in a position now in my business where if I get three emails from clients in one day saying, hey, I'm canceling your service, if I get three of those in one day, that's a bad day and I've got a problem. But if I get one of those in a month, I'm fine. And history tells me that on average, I'm probably never going to lose three clients in one day. So I'm now in a position where between my cash reserve and a diverse set of clients that I'm pretty comfortable and safe financially. So if I have a client where the relationship sours, I no longer have to stay in an unhealthy client relationship for the money. The same thing has to be true in an employment situation. You have to build up enough of a cash reserve so that if things ever do get really unhealthy for you in that job, you can move away from it. The worst case scenario, the situation that makes me sick to think about is the person who knows the job doesn't have anything else to offer him or her in terms of relationship value, new skill development, quality of work, all of that. If none of that is there and they don't have a cash reserve, that is, to me, that is the worst feeling imaginable because you feel trapped. And I don't like that feeling. So you got to build a cash reserve to never feel trapped.
Well, and that goes back to the importance of this annual review, right? So if you don't have a cash reserve that would allow you to feel safe, mm-hmm. then that can be one of the things, again, whether you have a fixed income or you have the opportunity to grow your income, you know, maybe you're on commissions. Maybe you do sales. Yeah. And so you're employed, but you do sales. And so you could say, okay, I want to make this. But the important thing is that you check in and you make a commitment to those dollars that they go there.
Right. And I try never to impose my goals on other people, my values on other people with their money. I will break that rule in this case and say, whatever feeling you're pursuing with your money right now, just trust me that having a cash reserve feels better than almost any other thing you can consume until you have it. And then you have it and you move back on to other things. But if you've never really had that month or 2 month buffer in your life, just financial buffer, just trust me, do an experiment on that. And you're like, well, I'd love to do an experiment. How do I get there? Well, take some of those dollars from every paycheck or every client payment or every sale, whatever it is, stuff them in an account and let them pile up and become your buffer. And you just got to believe me, nothing feels better.
Well, I think the important thing, like, because when I've done some money coaching with people, it was like, even if it's $5 and you put it in a mason jar and you celebrate that, and every week you put in that $5, at the end of the month, it's $20. That's $20 that you didn't have. Mm-hmm. And then that small skill. And I had somebody do that, years ago, and they were kind of like, really, $5? And later they followed up with me and they're like, oh my gosh, that small skill set finally got them in that motion, and they mm-hmm. finally started their kids' college savings account that they just hadn't ever gotten around to doing, but it was kind of getting them used to. It's like, it's the idea of go get, you know, gym shoes on and go for a walk around the block. And eventually you're going to get to the gym. Take those small steps to get there. But so the big thing is, whether it's $5, $100, $200, $1,000, whatever the number is for you, it's important that you celebrate that number.
But I feel like your advice is so good at the level that you gave it, which is there will be people who say, okay, my monthly burn rate in my finances is $6,000. So I really want to have that reserve built up within 6 months. So I'm going to put away $1,000 a month. And then they'll build a plan for putting away $1,000 a month in their emergency fund. And then in month one, their dishwasher goes out. And now they got to spend $400 to $800 on a new dishwasher. And that, you know, that's either half or most of that $1,000 they were going to set aside for that emergency fund. And they're just That's it. They're so discouraged. If you start out at a $5 mason jar, start out with that kind of a habit, you will find, which I'm sure your client found, Corinne, that the $5 habit doesn't last very long because it quickly becomes a $10 habit. And then you get a little bit of a, you've gotten a taste of that control and that progress in your life. And then a $10 habit becomes a 20, becomes a 60, becomes a $100 habit. And eventually you get to that $1,000 per month savings rate. But you did it in a way that never really set you up for a crushing setback. And now the habit is there, and the habit probably doesn't go away. When I look at my budget, when I, you know, get paid by a client, what am I going to do with this money? I just look at that category, that reserve category. And mine's okay now. You know, I think I have $12,000 or something in my reserve. It's good. It's not what I want it to be, say, in 6 months, but every penny I can, I love to sweep it over and stuff it into that buffer category, because it just feels like, as a person who seeks freedom, that's why I'm self-employed. I seek freedom. That buffer category is my freedom category, because it's what lets me break up with bad clients or say no to bad clients. Luckily, I haven't had to do that very often, but it gives me the feeling that I could do that, and there's not a better feeling for me.
Well, and so the feeling comes from the thought that that feeling, you're right, there's a story that's behind that feeling, and it's like, it gives you permission to break up with clients. You know that. You know you're not stuck with maybe a client that you don't want to be, or you are in more control of your life because if a client cancels, you have that. And so it's so important for people to understand that these are all choices. And the other thing is, when you're talking about, you know, saving, because I think the old me, I used to do this with exercise when I retired as a swimmer. I trained 3 or 4 hours a day, and all of a sudden I was, you know, going to swim at master swimming, and it was only an hour. And I was like, well, this is a waste of time. It's only an hour. What good can I get out of an hour, right? I can't be in as good of shape as I was when I was a collegiate athlete. Well, of course not. But that wasn't the point, right? I wasn't trying to be swimming these fast times. I wasn't going to compete anymore. But so then I was like, well, forget it. Don't even need to go exercise. So for years I wasn't exercising, and I was eating those 3 bowls of ice cream because, you know, I deserved it. Right. And all of a sudden one day I woke up and I went, oh my gosh, how did I get here? Right? Because I put my hand in the sand. And so it's like this with money. Instead of like, okay, yeah, stuff happens. We have these plans. We have these annual plans. We have the reviews. Stuff happens. But maybe instead of putting away the $1,000, maybe it's $500 or $300 or $200 or $10. And you have to celebrate that and say, I did it. I honored the commitment to myself, and I'm going to keep doing it. And I'm instead of, because what you said, I think at the beginning of the show was so brilliant. People overestimate what they can accomplish in a year and underestimate what they spend, right? And it's we may overestimate what we're going to save and actually underestimate, you know, I don't know. I can't think of it. I've just lost my train of thought.
But you underestimate what you're going to spend. It's exactly true. It's the classic in personal finance. It's the classic, we're going to buckle down and we're never eating out. It's like like the classic cliche. Well, of course you're going to eat out. If you have a habit of eating out, you're not going to break it tomorrow. So don't set yourself up to feel like a moron or to feel like a loser when you go eat out, when the reality is you've had that habit for a long time and you're getting something from it. So when you set up this plan, the savings plan, set up a savings plan that's just a no-brainer. It's just like, well, that's easy. It's like it's the master swimming thing. Well, that's not going to accomplish anything. Well, yes, it is. You're going to be shocked at what it's going to accomplish for you. So anyway, your point was a good one.
Well, and then the other thing I think that becomes important is, so like on Friday mornings, I usually have coffee with a girlfriend, and we wound up meeting at her house. And last night my plan was, oh, I'm going to still stop by and get my coffee and go. Well, I have those beans in my house, and I can make now a really good cup of coffee. But I was like, no, I'm going to go. And this morning I was working, and I made a choice. Do I want to go get the coffee and spend that $5.40, which apparently I'm still having a hard time getting over, or do I want to make my coffee? And it really, either way, again, it's not going to affect my family, right? But I thought about it, and I was like, it will make my life a lot simpler because I won't spend that 15 minutes of driving and walking out and all of that and then getting back in and getting in the car. I can just go straight from my house to her house, and I'll have my coffee done. And then yay me, I save the $5.40 for another day. but it's not, it wasn't out of deprivation, which I think a lot of that old personal finance stuff was. It was about, see, if you're good, let me shame you into not spending money.
Right.
Right. Which at some point, that's why I was eating the three bowls of ice cream. Right. Because it was like, I could only contain for so long and then I was just going to rebel.
Yes. Yep.
So
all this is all, what's funny is with personal finance, it's like, it's the exact same conversation you have about dieting, right? I mean, it's the same psychology, same motivations, same mistakes, same like deprivation followed by binge habits. It's all the same thing. And people know at this point, dieting doesn't really work. It doesn't produce a result you want in the long run. Well, neither does super harsh austerity type spending where it's like, I'm never eating out, I'm never buying new clothes, I'm never, you know, like that's just dieting applied to money. And it fails exactly the way that dieting with food does. It fails in the same way for the same reasons. So just skip it and create a plan that works. And it's probably a cent per day or $5 per week, whatever that plan is initially, do it and then let it build its own momentum.
And then I love this idea how you talk about checking in, right? Checking at the end of the year. And I love the idea of looking at, and that's actually what I'm going to be doing, is looking at last year's money from the whole, because now you're getting the whole picture instead of that week when your dishwasher died, you know, a toilet exploded, because that's typically how it happens, and your garage door will no longer open, right? That's 1 week, but you've got to look at it over the course of the year instead of 1 week, because that 1 week doesn't define the entire year.
The first year is the hardest, of course, because it's easy for us that have been tracking our finances for at least a couple years to do this annual review. People who are listening to this who have not been expense trackers by habit, they're listening to this like, yeah, great guys, you have your records. I don't have any records. I've got 7 different credit cards. I've got 3 checking accounts. I got that home equity line of credit. I don't even know how to account for that. So I feel for you guys out there that are in that position. There's nothing wrong with you. You're very normal. Start today and become a person who keeps high awareness of your finances. So track your spending in a pen and paper ledger. Track it in mint.com, which is a free tracking tool. You know, the software I love is called YNAB. You need a budget.com. You can use that. But just decide you're just going to keep your finger on the pulse of your money over an extended period of time so that you can learn from that in next year's annual review. If all you did was track your spending every day this year, every month this year, so that you could do next year's annual review, it would have been a very worthwhile exercise.
Oh, absolutely. And once you get your systems in place, it becomes that much easier.
Really easy. Yep.
So it's like we're talking about start with $5 of savings.
Yep.
Right. And don't discount that. Well, Mark, thank you so much today for coming on today and talking about this. I love talking about money.
Likewise. It's always so fun to be here, and I appreciate you having me.
Well, thank you, Mark. All right. So a couple things I want to clarify. One is when Mark was talking about the feeling, like what's the feeling you want from purchasing that experience? The one thing I do want to clarify is that our feelings come from the stories that we tell ourselves, right? It's not from the purchasing of a car, going on a trip. It's the thoughts that we think which create those feelings. So just pay attention to that. And then the other thing is that when you do go and have that experience, are you really getting those feelings? I was telling Mark that when I was in my job and I was really unhappy and miserable, but you know, the story in my head was, well, Corinne, this is as good as it gets, just suck it up. And I'd have some time, I would, again, that I deserve it, right? Which was totally rooted in shame and scarcity. And it was kind of like, actually, it was me trying to disconnect from shame and not enough, because this was as good as my life could get. And so I was running away from it and just, or not running away, I was what I call inner gladiator. Like, I deserve this. Let me go and do this, right? Let me eat 3 bowls of ice cream because I want to be the boss of me. Or I'm going to go shopping. Let me show them. I don't know who I was showing. It was my pocketbook. But I would go shopping and I would go to Nordstrom Rack because I was getting, you know, something that was going to be on sale and not spend a lot of money. And I go buy these clothes and it wasn't anything that I really liked or really wanted or even needed because it was what was there. And I didn't have any joy from it, but it was like that third bowl of ice cream. it was kind of relief. It was like getting that high in that moment until I came home and then I threw the bag because I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I spent this money and should I have spent it? And there's all this story in my head. And I leave the bag in the bottom of my closet for months. And then I'd have even more shame because here it was, I'm not being very responsible, yada, 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 yada. So I thought I was going for this feeling of, oh, see, I deserve it. But it was really rooted in shame. And so it didn't feel very good. And then when I started to check in with that, like, oh, I have this, it's creating problems, it's hassles, either I return it or I lose money and I feel guilt. And because I didn't know what shame was back then, many, you know, years ago, this is probably a decade ago. And so I started evaluating. And it didn't mean that once I understood it intellectually, did I change something right away. But over time, I stopped doing that. It used to be this huge returner of things because, you know, I couldn't waste my money. But now I really work on buying things that I really, really love and that I really want. That's in line with the story in my head and how I feel. And then I do it and I experience, is this really true? Another example could be this idea of Disneyland being the happiest place on the planet. Like if you go and look at Disneyland, it's really not that happy. There's a lot of tears. Parents are stressed out. I think I've talked about this before. I typically have a pretty good time there, but I know it's an experience and the workers there are very nice to you because that's part of their employee like handbook and it's fun, but I don't go there with really, really outrageous expectations. And I also don't go there from this place of scarcity, right? We go there, we have a good time, we walk away. And the other thing is that we have kind of a limit on how long we'll be there throughout each day because our capacity to enjoy it hits a tipping point as well. So checking in, and everybody's different. There's no right or wrong. Checking in with what is the story? What is the feeling? And then circling back and going, is that really how I felt when I went through that experience? And if it's not, do I need to change? What needs to change? And that's really what he's talking about with the annual review. And I know when he was starting really talking about like hardcore numbers, I was like, oh, you know, and I told him afterwards, I was like, oh, I was just thinking of spreadsheets. And I actually use a lot of Excel spreadsheets. But the way he was talking about it, I was like, oh. But when you can go from that compassionate observer place and say, okay, look at it, not to beat yourself up, not to say, oh, I'm stupid, not to use it as evidence, but here I am. This is where I wanted to be. What's the gap? And if I want to be someplace different next year, where can I go from there? So I really invite you to take a stock, take an inventory or an annual review of where you are and where you want to go, and then check in. The biggest problem is when we put our head in the sand and then we come up later and go, oh my gosh, it's not my fault. Somebody else did it. We're not being emotional adults when we do that. We're being emotional children. So checking in, doing annual reviews. If you don't like that, if that sounds too corporate-y or too money, make a name for it. It doesn't have to be annual review. It could be your money check-in. Your yearly money check-in. And I love what he had to say about the idea of looking at your money from a year perspective. And I think it's good to look at it. He talks about weekly, monthly, quarterly, and then yearly. So it's not just one or the other. It's taking in different data. And as I say on the show often, these are data points. They do not define you. They're data points. All right. We are building a community here at How She Really Does It. Go to my website and sign up for the weekly newsletter. There's also my free audio series for the Daring Way intro. It's only available via the newsletter. You're going to get an email every day with a short 5 to 10 minute audio. I invite you to that. And I want to do a shout out. I said on another show that I just realized recently that there's all these different countries of iTunes reviews, which I hadn't known. I'd only been looking at the United States ones. So I'm in Canada right now. I'm not in Canada, but I'm in the Canada iTunes. And I love Canadians. They're awesome. I've spent many, many summers up in Canada. My heart is very soft for Canada. I have very, very fond memories. I spent a lot of summers up in Northern, I don't know if it's Northern Ontario, but Ontario, Canada, up past Parry Sound on a lake called Amic Lake. It's for me, it's home. So I just adore Canadians. And I want to do a shout out to Wee Mac J, who left a review back in December 2014. I'm sorry I didn't recognize you a long time ago, but I didn't know it was there. I'm learning. And thanks so much for leaving the iTunes review. And I'm so glad that the show's helping you in your life. All right, you guys, I'm smiling big for you. Until next time.
On a lake, she is dreaming, she is drifting, never been so well.